Good morning, Your Honors. May I please the court, Mark Walter, registration numbers 30990, appearing on behalf of Mark Weeks, the appellant in this matter. There can be no doubt that whatever befell this little girl, whether it be an accident or an act of child abuse, was tragic and undeserved. At the same time, there can be no doubt that Mr. Weeks deserved a fairer trial than he received in this case. Now, we've raised a number of claims on appeal. For purposes of argument, I'm going to focus on two aspects of the trial that we view as particularly unfair. First, the improper admission of 404B evidence that allowed the jury to convict Mr. Weeks on the basis of bad character, rather than on the basis of proof of the crimes actually charged in this case. The second is defendant's conviction for child abuse resulting in death that both arose from a constructive amendment of the charging instrument and rests on insufficient evidence. Obviously, I'll take questions from the court with respect to any of the issues raised in the brief, but I'm going to focus primarily on those two issues. And with that, I'll turn first to the 404B issue. We submit that this court's decisions in Casillas and Del Sordo are dispositive of the issue before the court. As in Casillas and Del Sordo, the primary issue is whether the prior acts challenged here were logically relevant, independent of any inference of bad character, to prove the more culpable mental state of the crimes allegedly committed. The prosecution claimed below, and the trial court agreed, that the evidence here was relevant to prove knowledge, intent, absence of mistake, and accident.
Didn't the trial court at the 404B hearing also say it was relevant to motive?
He did, Your Honor. It did not. The limiting instruction did not reflect that.
Did trial defense counsel at trial object to the limiting instruction as being more narrow than the 404B ruling?
Well, no. He didn't, and I don't know why he would, because obviously a more expansive instruction allows the jury to consider the evidence for broader purposes. Defense counsel did lodge sort of a general continuing objection to the admission of this evidence, and the court, although I know this court generally disfavors those sorts of continuing objections, the court trial court permitted.
Are we permitted then to consider whether or not the evidence would have been admissible for motive as the trial court had found?
Well, the jury certainly didn't consider it for that purpose, and I think that that's the proper focus of the court's inquiry.
So if the evidence was admissible for motive, but the jury wasn't told about motive, you would say it would be a reversible error for the lack of the word motive in the instruction?
I agree, because we presume that the jury follows the court's instructions, and if the jury didn't consider it for a proper purpose, then I think the court must conclude, assuming that it finds that the purposes on which the jury was instructed, that they could consider it for, assuming that the court finds that those were improper, the court must conclude that there's reversible error.
But is the error admission of the evidence, which at least in my view was very probative motive, or is the error in not including motive in the instruction to which trial counsel didn't object?
Well, I think in the end, Your Honor, the error was the express purpose for which the prosecution argued that the evidence should be considered. And in my view, viewing the arguments made by the prosecution, both closing and rebuttal, it was pure propensity. It did not go to motive at all, but that was not their argument in the least.
Okay, but at that point then, I mean, I guess where I get confused is it seems to me almost you're almost retroactively assessing admissibility, you know, first based on the instruction and then even more narrowly based on the prosecutor's closing argument, to which I'm assuming there was no objection on the grounds that you're raising now.
There wasn't, and we've admitted as much in our opening.
Okay, well, then I mean, can we retroactively evaluate the admissibility of the evidence based on the prosecutor's unobjected to closing?
Well, I think that the court has to view the admissibility in light of the purposes for which it was ultimately admitted.
Okay, but why isn't that judged on the basis of the 404B hearing arguments rather than retrospectively?
Had the jury been specifically instructed that the evidence was admissible for motive, I'm in no way conceding that I believe that the evidence was admissible for that purpose.
Yeah, I'm not asking you to concede that. Well, let's assume
for the sake of argument.
Hold on one second. Do we know how much time is left on your argument?
I have 9 minutes and 35 seconds
here. Good. Do you have anything on yours, Judge?
No.
I don't have anything on mine either. You're on your own until the bailiff tells us you're done.
Okay. I'll take advantage.
Okay, with that, please begin again. Sorry.
But as I was saying, I think the fact that the evidence at the time of the court's ruling may have been admitted for motive is separate and apart from the purpose for which the evidence was ultimately admitted at trial and the arguments that the prosecution made in terms of the purposes for which the jury could consider that evidence as admitted. If the jury had no idea that the evidence was admissible for motive, and the prosecution made no argument to that effect, you must assume that the jury confined its consideration of the evidence to the specific purposes for which it was admitted: knowledge, intent, lack of mistake, accident.
Counsel, I'm sorry to cut you off, but as you can tell, I'm impatient to get to the next question. The question I have is, let's assume we agree with you about Casillas and maybe Del Sordo as it relates to knowledge and intent. Why isn't this evidence admissible to show lack of accident? Because that was part of the case. Was this an accident, a flopping accident where the little girl hits her head on the stove? Why isn't this evidence admissible to show that it wasn't an accident, and that the defendant would have been responsible not for the mental state but for the actus reus?
And I strain, Your Honor, to figure out how it's probative of lack of accident, how the fact that Mr. Weeks may have mistreated a puppy on occasions, the fact that Mr. Weeks may have mistreated a cat on occasions,
for urinating in the house. The very same thing which G.W. had said, A.M., I think, was mistreated.
Which may have gone to motive. I agree with that.
But not lack of accident.
Because it doesn't shed any light on, first of all, whether or not an accident occurred, but moreover, whether Mr. Weeks had intent or mens rea with respect to...
No, we're talking about whether he did the act as opposed to whether it was an accident. I'm not talking about his mens rea. I'm talking about whether or not it tends to make more probable than without the evidence that he, rather than the little girl, was the cause of the injuries.
And I would submit that you only get there through the prohibited intermediate inference. That he's a bad guy, that he's an abuser. The fact that he allegedly perpetrated not physical abuse, but really emotional abuse on the other two stepchildren.
Go ahead.
To my mind, it sheds absolutely no light whatsoever on lack of accident in this case. It may suggest, and of course that was the defense's concern, that it did suggest quite clearly that he was a bad guy. The defense devoted, the virtual or a good bulk of its closing argument to rebutting that inference.
What about the acts involving the cats and the dog?
Again,
that's more than emotional abuse, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. It's animal abuse, to be sure. But
there's no analogy between child abuse and animal abuse.
I'm not saying that there never is. I'm saying in this case, for the purposes that the evidence was admitted, that it lacks sufficient probative value. I don't think that it's probative of lack of accident.
How is this different from the sexual assault cases in which the defendant raises consent as to the charge defense? And then the prosecution puts in evidence of other sexual assaults committed under similar circumstances? I mean, isn't the consent issue in that case similar to the accident issue in this case?
And not to be flip, Your Honor, but, you know, the better analogy would be, in that sort of a case, the prosecution admitting evidence of bestiality. Is that probative in any way? Does that bear at all on the issue of consent? I don't think so. And, you know, it's, I think it's easy to focus on the dissimilarities between the animal, the alleged animal abuse in this case, and the acts that were alleged to have been committed by Mr. Weeks against AM. But even the evidence with respect to the other two girls, I find entirely dissimilar and not probative at all in terms of his mental state or whether or not this this was an accident.
Why aren't the animals' incidents similar? There's, you know, you're taking an animal that has urinated and you're taking a reaction in one instance, holding or cats against the wall, the other slamming a dog against the wall. Why isn't that similar, sufficient and enough incidents, perhaps sufficient to support a tendency beyond character, almost a Dr. Chance's point, that yeah, it's more likely he did this, and it had not to do with bad character, but he's doing things enough times that it creates the likelihood that he did things this time.
And I agree with Your Honor that this evidence was admitted, and the prosecution did in fact argue under the doctrine of chances that Mr. Weeks was more likely to have committed the act against AM because of these prior acts. But at the same time, what I think the law demands is similarity between those acts. And, you know, at a basic level, the acts are dissimilar in that I don't think that there's any allegation or proof that, you know, the puppy slamming incident or the spraying the cat with the bottle resulted in any serious injury, much less death.
Well, and you're right, there's no evidence of death there. You can't infer that the puppy may have been injured, or the fact that perhaps the ex-wife or wife, I forget, gave the puppy away out of fear for the puppy's safety.
There was evidence to that effect, but there wasn't any evidence in it. And in fact, I think the evidence was the puppy was not injured when that occurred, but the ex did testify that she ultimately elected to give away the puppy out of fear for its safety. There's obviously a disagreement here about the probative value of this evidence. Assuming that the court agrees with me that it was error to admit this evidence, I just want to quickly touch upon the issue of harmlessness, because, and I'm treading on thin ice here because Judge Haley wrote Casillas, but I would submit that the harmlessness analysis in Casillas is questionable. But, you know, a quantitative approach to harmlessness is problematic from my perspective. The fact that you can say, well, the evidence only, and arguments with respect to that evidence only occupied, you know, 4 pages of a 700-page record, that doesn't seem to me to be the proper inquiry into the harmfulness of the error. In the final analysis, I think that the focus should be on how the prosecution used it and the extent to which the prosecution focused on that evidence in closing and rebuttal. And there's no doubt that, you know, for the length of this trial and the number of witnesses presented, and the number of pieces of physical evidence, the focus on these acts was disproportionate. And the prosecution clearly understood, you know, the prejudicial and perhaps unfairly prejudicial value of this evidence. And as I noted, the defense spent considerable time in its closing attempting to rebut the negative inferences from this evidence. With that, I would ask the court to reverse the condition on this basis. I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Would you please hold the time for a second? And how much time is left on the rebuttal?
51 seconds.
Okay. Before your 51 seconds, you had mentioned you wanted to address a second issue, the sufficiency of the evidence. Does that depend upon, let me ask you one question, does that depend upon how the statute is interpreted? You know, whether or not engaged in a pattern that causes something, that ultimately causes something, or engaged in a pattern that causes X, engaged in a pattern that causes Y, engaged in a pattern that causes accumulation of injuries that causes something. Does it depend upon statutory interpretation?
I think it does, Your Honor. And with respect, as we noted, that the prosecution charged under all three sort of broad theories of child abuse resulting in death, but in the end only pursued the third. There are multiple different ways within that, that third category of committing the offense, two of which were not charged in the indictment, but were ultimately instructed on. That's the constructive amendment.
Must all of them ultimately result in serious bodily injury or death, or could a pattern result solely in cruel punishment, period, without serious bodily injury or death?
I think what the statute requires, Your Honor, is the act element and the injury element. And there has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt of both, and there has to be a nexus between them. That's the way that I read the statute. That it's not simply enough to have a pattern of mistreatment or cruel punishment, that it must in the end result in death. And I think each category of child abuse under the statute is trained on a very specific course of conduct resulting in death or injury to the child.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
And you'll get your full 51 seconds when you come back.
I appreciate it.
May it please the Court, my name is Jay Fisher. I represent the people in this matter, registration number 44350. Admittedly, if you look at just the plain facts of the 404B evidence that was tendered into evidence at trial, and also the CS opinion, on first blush, there could be difficulties with how the prosecution handled this matter and how the trial court admitted the evidence at trial. However, upon further analysis, the evidence was still admissible under SPOTO and the four-part analysis there to show the defendant's state of mind, the motive, a lack of mistake or accident, and what it showed was a person who acted irrationally and at times violently.
What do we do with the fact that the jury wasn't instructed on motive?
In fact, I take issue with that in that when the 404B evidence was tendered into evidence at trial, there was a limiting instruction that did mention motive.
It did mention motive?
To the best of my recollection, yes, Your Honor. It was specifically worded within the limited instruction. Now, in terms of the final instructions, it may not have been there. However,
I thought the final instructions largely were repetitious of the earlier instructions.
That would be correct, Your Honor. As I mentioned before, it was admissible under the four-part SPOTO test. It related to a material fact. It answered very important questions for the jury. It answered who, it answered how, and it answered why as to the events that ultimately led to A.W.'s death. It was logically relevant. It showed a pattern here. It showed a pattern of a defendant who reacted violently with dependents who had accidents involving bodily substances.
Let's look at the incidents involving NB and KB. What violence was there? What kind of violence was involved in those incidents?
It was mental and psychological. And in fact, the child abuse statute...
Does mental and psychological have much to do to tell us whether or not it was physical in our case?
It would go to show a pattern. And it's important to show that, you know, the pattern was an element that the jury had to consider here. And what I mean by pattern is it shows an evolution of irrational conduct on the defendant's part. And what I mean by that is earlier on with the stepchildren, when the children had accidents in the home, he would behave irrationally. He would inflict, you know, punishment that was completely out of proportion to the wrong, if I can even consider that, considering that they're minor children.
Sitting them in time out, is that out of proportion to the wrong?
If you consider the time frame that it occurred at, which was very late at night, and keeping them up disproportionately long, yes. In fact, it was, as mentioned before, it's an evolution. This is conduct that has a crescendo up to a point where, you know...
So your thought is there's a sequence, and the abuse against the children occur first, then the abuse against the cats, then the abuse against the dog, Does the record support that sequence?
The record instead would support that, in fact, the pet abuse happened first, at least the version with the dog, because the dog happened with a girlfriend that was prior to GW.
So how's it going to crescendo in sitting a child perhaps to the side and in timeout late at night? How's that probative of whether or not how he might have reacted against AM?
I would be speculating if I was to provide a thought process of how the defendant, but a logical read of that is, in fact, that we have a difference here between pets and humans, which the court has already indicated. Obviously, with pets, there could be an indication, you know, with the defendant's mind, again, speculating, that these are different than humans, and that once he is dealing with humans who have similar incidents, he has this irrational reaction, and then when he's...
He has an irrational reaction. If you're saying, okay, we've changed from pets to humans, and therefore this leads us to believe that he did it with AM, there's nothing in the incidents about with NB and KB suggesting he'd be violent.
I would agree that no violence happened, but again, it has to do with this evolution of extreme punishment on his part. It may not start off as violent, but it's completely out of proportion to the law. The jurors in this case were, you know, just average citizens who understand that minor children are going to have accidents. The issue becomes, what kind of reaction does a parent have in these incidents when faced with problems with their children? And I would submit that at least late at night, well past a child's bedtime, when they urinate the bed, keeping them up extremely calm, while it's unknown who addressed the urination in the bed, is in fact indicative of a pattern of abuse. It starts off as mental and psychological, it evolves to physical. Regarding the second prong of the logically relevant, I already touched upon that, this evolution of behavior, this irrational reaction that eventually leads to violence. There's a third factor, which is the relevance independent of bad character inference. The Snyder opinion says that there doesn't have to be a complete absence of bad character. The relevance has to be independent of the bad inference instead. And that's what we have here. We can almost set this up as an equation. You have a dependent, be either a pet or a human being, they have an accident that involves a bodily substance, and it leads to an irrational or, at times, violent reaction on the defendant's part, or on the defendant's part, excuse me. Finally, there's the issue of the probative value being greater than the prejudice, and that's what we have here. Again, this is a situation with a defendant who basically did an everything in the kitchen sink approach to his defense at trial. The original defense was to blame GW. Then when he closed the trial, there was evidence insufficiency. The jury was also informed of his sworn statements to law enforcement where he's blaming everybody except having any kind of involvement in the issue himself. So these were all questions for the jury to consider, the who did it, the how it was done, and the why it was done. The prejudicial value was decreased because there were appropriate limiting instructions that were provided to the jury in this particular case. Now, regarding the harmless error, this was not an issue where there was a battle of the experts. This was strictly based upon the evidence of various witnesses, be them experts or lay witnesses. The 404B evidence, in fact, was a very small part of the case. However, the case in chief for the prosecution was monumental against the defendants, the best way to describe it.
Isn't this a question of whodunit?
Absolutely.
And was the evidence fairly, you know, overwhelming on that point?
As a whodunit?
We had GW testify whodunit. We had the other bad acts, which may have been inadmissibly admitted or inadmissible. And what other evidence was there tending to corroborate defendant as the whodunit? Or perhaps not an accident?
Well, there was a testimony, first of all, that she showed fear, substantial and measurable fear when the defendant was around. There was a testimony that there was a block of time prior to her death when the defendant was the person who had most contact with her. The wife was working outside the home, and the defendant was the principal caretaker while he was unemployed. There was a testimony that the injuries that were inflicted on the child required great force. These were greater forces than a child could generate either by accident or flopping or whatever the defendant may have said occurred with the child. The defendant also gave a number of implausible explanations as to the bruising. There was his questionable and strange conduct when he was in the hospital. As to questions he was answering, there were statements that were overheard in the hospital. There was the issue of, I believe at one point, he even said that in one conversation he was having with GW that we need to tell individuals or anyone of authority, the child fell off a roof. And there were also the text messages that were tendered with into evidence with GW where he said, we need to get our story straight. I mean, it seems to indicate that there was some kind of plan of cover. Finally, you had the issue of the telephone calls that were tendered into evidence at the jail. These calls were problematic for two points. And the first one being that the defendant said at one point that the victim was fine when he returned home, when a big part of the defense in this case was that the ultimately fatal injury was inflicted while he was gone. Then there's the second issue of the phone calls, which is where he said that he was, or I should say that GW, in fact, is the person who came up with the idea of the flopping, and he went along with it. That would ultimately indicate that he was somehow part and parcel of a cover-up here. Regarding the second issue of the evidence insufficiency, I would submit, in fact, this is a matter of statutory interpretation. And the issue here becomes how you would interpret the wording here, the continued pattern of conduct that resulted in cruel punishment or mistreatment. And then there's the conjunctive word or, and then the other part, an accumulation of injuries.
Did you ever argue in your briefs that there was a difference, that the engaged in pattern resulting in cruel punishment did not reference or did not also apply to the ultimately resulting in serious bodily injury or death? Did you ever argue that?
Well, we argued that the evidence, in fact, showing a pattern was overwhelming. And to differentiate, at least, from the accumulation of injuries, it's a matter of how the plain wording of these two sections of the statute, in fact, are reasoned out. The pattern of cruel conduct would indicate, as I mentioned before, you have a crescendo here of behavior. And they start off as physical or mental, and then eventually...
But does the pattern have to also ultimately result in serious bodily injury or death?
Yes,
but... For all of those named patterns or enumerated patterns?
It would have to result in death, but again, it depends on mechanism of death.
Malnourishment had to ultimately result, the pattern of malnourishment had to ultimately result in serious bodily injury or death.
If malnourishment was an issue
right.
for the jury to consider.
Or cruel punishment
correct.
Had to result in injury or death.
Absolutely.
Or lack of proper medical care, if that had been the issue, had to result in injury or serious bodily injury or death.
That's correct. Okay. But again, it depends on what the mechanism of injury was. And in this case, we only have one mechanism of injury, and that was the subdural hematoma. And the subdural hematoma was the result of, this pattern of cruel punishment and mistreatment. Now, the accumulation of injury portion of the statute would be more indicative of if we had a number of serious injuries, but the medical experts could not, in fact, put their finger upon one. In other words, if the child had a collapsed lung, if there was a cardiac contusion, if there was a major bleed somewhere in the body, and an expert said we cannot put our finger on any one particular form of death, but ultimately, when taken together, this would lead to death. In this case, we know exactly what the mechanism was, and the mechanism was the end result of this pattern of cruel punishment.
Doesn't your argument, though, kind of eliminate one of the causation links between pattern results in what was alleged here, cruel punishment. Pattern results in cruel punishment, ultimately results in death. Isn't your construction a pattern that results in cruel punishment and that the child is seriously injured or suffers death? In other words, doesn't it eliminate that second causal link?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because ultimately it depends on the evidence in the case. And what we have here, as I mentioned before, is this evolution, this increase of punishment on the victim AW in this case that ultimately leads to the fatal injury. So there's no missing element here. Again, it just depends on what the expert said, and all the experts said that this was ultimately one injury that killed the victim. And this court has no further questions. We ask that you affirm the conviction below. Thank you.
I actually think that opposing counsel and I may not be that far apart in terms of our understanding and interpretation of the third category of child abuse. I think it does focus in on situations in which there is a pattern of mistreatment or an accumulation of injury where no identifiable act can be identified as the sole cause for the injury. However, that's not what we have here. I don't think that there was any dispute amongst the experts or even on the part of the defense that there was a single injury that caused this little girl to die.
And it's your interpretation of the statute that where there is such a single incident, it doesn't apply?
No, there's another provision of the statute that covers that, Your Honor.
Of the child abuse statute?
Of the child abuse statute.
Okay. So let's take, we're not getting, I'll read out on your time.
I have 12 seconds.
This may take longer.
It's now counting upwards.
That means you're in the hole, but don't worry, not to worry. Okay. let's assume a defendant was prosecuted under the pattern of lack of adequate medical care. And the testimony was that there was an ongoing pattern of lack of medical care, but there was one discrete failure to take the child to a physician, and that's what killed the child. Is it prosecutable or not? In other words, the nexus to death isn't the multiple lesser failures to treat. It's one very specific, the child had a bad laceration and just bled out because they didn't take the child to the hospital. Is that, under your interpretation of the statute, is that prosecutable as it was here or not?
I think I'm fairly certain that it would be. I'm not sure that it would be under that particular provision of the statute, though.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. With that, we ask that the court vacate the conviction and or reverse. Thank you.
I want to thank counsel for their excellent arguments in this case, and the case will be submitted and opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both very much for arguments. Thank you.